a mere 600 years ago. But it seems that as though the Vatican is sort of thinking about it now. They're issuing all sorts of press releases to squelch the idea that when Benedict retires, there will once again be two popes.
Well, he has said very clearly, I will renounce the authority. And in that case, de facto, he does not have the authority. He cannot speak with the authority of St. Peter. While we're in unprecedented territory, we're not in uncharted territory. And in fact, Gregory XII, going back to 1415, lived out his life as a cardinal.
Professor Christopher Bellido, he's a historian at Kane University in New Jersey. Professor Bellido, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
And you're listening to the Morning Edition on KALW San Francisco. Pardon me for just a moment there. You are listening to Morning Edition on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, your local public radio station, and the listener-supported broadcast service of the San Francisco Unified School District, which brings us to today's school lunch menu for the public schools in San Francisco. It's breakfast for lunch day. The choices in the elementary, middle, and high schools are chicken and waffles or egg and waffles. And in the middle and high schools, students also have the choice of roast beef sandwich or teriyaki chicken stir fry. Both of those come with the romaine side salad. In school news, on Valentine's Day, that's tomorrow, a flash mob of students and staff will perform the dance Break the Chain during lunchtime at Washington High School. The flash mob style dance is part of an international event called 1 Billion Rising, where this year 182 countries are staging events to bring attention to the worldwide issue of violence against women. Later in the day, students from several San Francisco Unified School District schools will be joining thousands at City Hall in observance of 1 Billion Rising. Again, that's tomorrow, Valentine's Day, at lunchtime at Washington High School.
How do we... On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Megan O'Rourke, author of the memoir, The Long Goodbye. She says most Westerners are uncomfortable around death, and the rituals that once guided mourners and communities have mostly disappeared. So what is grief? And what is it like to mourn when there are so few rituals for observing and externalizing grief? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. How have you coped with the death of a loved one? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
That's this morning at 10 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. You're listening to Morning Edition.
NPR's business news starts with an unlikely call for assistance. The federal government needs help as it tries to distribute billions of dollars to struggling homeowners in foreclosure. The money is from that recent settlement with big banks over their questionable foreclosure practices. And as the New York Times reports, it's the banks themselves that are being asked to dole out the cash to homeowners. Regulators think having the banks do it could help speed up the process. But the Times says housing advocates worry the banks will take shortcuts.
General Electric will soon have to pay rent if it wants to keep offices in the famed 30 Rockefeller Plaza building in New York City. The skyscraper is being sold to Comcast. It's part of a more than $18 billion deal to take full ownership of NBC Universal. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
There were so many years of jokes about GE's ownership of NBC. Take NBC's 30 Rock, like when Jack Donaghy, Alec Baldwin, announces his title after he moves from one part of GE to run TV production.
I'm the new vice president of East Coast television and microwave oven programming.
Still, the uneasy relationship lasted some 30 years until 2011. Then GE sold Comcast a 51% stake of NBC Universal and promised to eventually sell them the rest. Now Comcast is the full owner of NBC Universal, and it gains all the profits from networks such as USA, Bravo, Sci-Fi, and Universal Film Studios. As TV goes everywhere, media analyst Bernard Gershon says Comcast will be able to use its internet service to provide you shows.
The Real Housewives of Orange County, for example, which is on Bravo, you'll be able to watch that on your television set, and you'll be able to watch it on your tablet or your smartphone at home or if you're sitting on the beach.
And from now on, you won't have to worry about your microwave oven streaming you the next episode of Law and Order. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
And after dedicating a chunk of his inaugural address to climate change, there was a lot of speculation about how President Obama would introduce the issue in his State of the Union speech last night. He came on strong, urging Congress to come up with bipartisan solutions. If not, the president said, quote, I will. He also talked about energy and pledged to cut red tape to make domestic drilling easier.
We produce more natural gas than ever before, and nearly everyone's energy bill is lower because of it.
Plus, all that domestic natural gas means the U.S. could see a dramatic rise in the amount of natural gas the U.S. exports. NPR's Jeff Brady took out some old bills of his own to consider what that might mean for future utility bills.
I'm looking at a copy of my utility bill from last month. It was cold here in Philadelphia, and heating our house with natural gas cost $182. In 2006, the same bill would have been $420, more than twice as much. Part of the reason our cost is down, and much of the rest of the country is paying less for gas now, is supply. The country's natural gas reserves are much higher now than just a few years ago. The U.S. Department of Energy is considering whether it's in the public interest to let companies export more of that natural gas, specifically to countries that don't have free trade agreements with the U.S. Sean Dixon is with the environmental group Clean Ocean Action, and he says that would have consequences.
Everyone is going to see a higher price point on their energy here, no matter what they use natural gas for, because the natural gas costs and the prices will go up.
The industry disputes this, saying more exports will lead to even more domestic production. But Dixon likes that even less.
When you have this incentive to send natural gas overseas, you're going to have the incentive there to produce more fracked natural gas.
Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is one of the technologies that has led to all the new gas reserves in the U.S., but many worry that it's polluting drinking water and turning rural landscapes into industrial zones. Companies like Cheniere Energy, based in Houston, want to export U.S. gas all over the world to countries like Spain, Japan, and Korea. One of Cheniere's applications has been approved. The other is pending. CEO Sharif Suki says more drilling in the U.S. would be a good thing.
You go and ask the good people of North Dakota, who have jobs and very high-paying jobs, whether they object to drilling in the United States, and I don't think you'll find too many people objecting.
Suki argues there's plenty of natural gas in the U.S. to both keep prices reasonable and to increase exports. Ultimately, he argues, it will benefit gas customers.
It's going to lead to a more stable market because we are now in a crazy situation that we have so much gas we cannot create markets for it.
But exporters face powerful opponents, American manufacturing and chemical companies. They see a lot of opportunity to use this cheap supply of natural gas here at home. Kevin Culliver is Vice President of Government Affairs and Public Policy at Dow Chemical.
For example, Dow has announced $4 billion in new investment in infrastructure in the Gulf Coast.
Dow and other companies plan to build new plants that could employ thousands of workers. But if gas exports increase and the wild price swings come back, Culliver says that will change.
You're going to see those projects pulled off the table. Worst case scenarios, you see those projects put on the table in other countries around the world because there's greater stability, price stability there.
Dow and other big companies want the Department of Energy to slowly increase gas exports. Decisions on 15 applications before the agency could come within weeks. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Today's last word in business is cash or charge or tweet. The credit card company American Express has teamed with Twitter to allow its customers to buy products just by tweeting about them. Here's how American Express explains it in a promotional video.
Just tweet special product hashtags for the items you want and then confirm your purchase. That's it. Your item will be delivered.
For those worried about security, Amex says the credit card information is on servers that are completely different from Twitter's, but customers must tweet their purchases publicly so everyone will know that you bought that One Direction album. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carbonite, providing automatic cloud backup solutions for individuals and small businesses. Learn more at carbonite.com. From Novo Nordisk, committed to diabetes care and changing lives for more than 90 years, novonordisk-us.com. And from Comité Champagne, with a reminder that while sparkling wines come from all over the world, champagne comes from Champagne, France, at champagne.us. This is NPR.
Later today on This American Life, when the new girl showed up at high school, Justin fell hard.
Oh, man, you know, she was mature in the body-wise because she was older than what she was saying.
Yeah, much older. Because Justin's new crush was an undercover cop. Justin didn't know when he asked her to the prom. Love stroke people and what they do for love later today.
This American Life, you can hear it at noon today here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco. Employer matching gifts can double or even triple your donation to KLW. KLW members working at more than 125 companies have already taken the step of asking their employers to match their contributions to KALW. Won't you do the same? Just ask your HR department if your company has a matching gift program, then fill out some simple paperwork. You can see a list of Bay Area employers who have matching gift programs in place on our website, KALW.org. Thanks for all you do to support KALW. It's 7 o'clock.
Good morning. After a deadly rampage, police cornered former L.A. officer Christopher Dorner in a mountain cabin, which burned to the ground. The dramatic chain of events on Morning Edition from NPR News. San Bernardino authorities haven't yet identified the remains as Dorner, the man they believe to be the alleged killer. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. In Washington last night, President Obama talked about the middle class, jobs, and raising the minimum wage. We'll have a close read of last night's State of the Union address. Also, companies facing down cyber threats. Airlines first unpacked their services and started charging separately for things like baggage. Now they're rebundling. Actress Kim Novak is 80 today. It's February 13th, Ash Wednesday. The news is next.
BBC News with Ian Purden. The United States and the European Union say they plan to start talks by the end of June on agreeing the world's largest ever bilateral trade deal. The aim is to cut import tariffs and regulations in a way that could set a standard for global trade liberalisation. The EU Trade Commissioner said he hoped a deal could be wrapped up within 2 years. Here's our Europe editor, Gavin Hewitt.
EU officials are describing it as a game changer, which over time would boost growth and jobs. It would add 0.5% to the EU economy every year once the deal was in place. There will be difficult areas, agreeing market access and removing tariff barriers. And one of the hardest questions to settle will be over agriculture. Both America and Europe strongly defend their farming sectors. These negotiations will not be easy, acknowledged EU officials. President Obama says the trade, which is free and fair across the Atlantic, will support millions of good-paying American jobs.
Pope Benedict has been applauded by thousands of worshippers at the Vatican in his first public appearance since the announcement of his resignation. He said he was fully conscious of the gravity of his decision to step down, the first pope to do so for six centuries. From Rome, Alan Little reports.
It was his traditional Wednesday audience, normally a routine affair, but infused this Wednesday with great symbolic significance. Thousands packed the audience hall and gave him a minute-long standing ovation before he spoke. Looking frail and speaking softly, he said he had taken the decision to resign after examining his conscience before God. He had done it in full freedom and for the good of the Church. Many of those listening had tears in their eyes. The initial shock that greeted his decision on Monday has given way to a mood of affection and sadness among those gathered here. This most traditional of popes ends his ministry in the most unexpected and least traditional of ways.
Ministers from the countries investigating the fraudulent labelling of horse meat will gather in Brussels shortly to discuss what further action may be appropriate. The European Health Commissioner, Tony Oborge, will also attend the meeting. He said to favour much tougher rules on product labelling. Christian Fraser reports.
The EU has not had compulsory country of origin labelling since 1981, but the events of recent weeks have shifted the debate to the issue of safety. How can a consumer make an informed choice if they've no idea where the food has come from? The new law that will be outlined today would bring greater transparency, though many are opposed. German footwear companies say no one would buy their high-end trainers if they knew they were largely produced in China. Food processors, like those who make frozen pizzas, argue many of their ingredients are sourced on a daily basis. Changing the labelling accordingly every day would be complex and expensive.
World News from the BBC. Afghan officials say a NATO airstrike in eastern Kunar province has killed 10 civilians, half of them children. Four Taliban commanders were also killed in the attack, which was aimed at one of their hideouts in the Shigal district. Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr has ordered a review of how diplomats handled the detention of an Australian man believed to have killed himself in an Israeli maximum security prison in 2010. An investigation by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation identified the man, previously known only as Prisoner X, as Ben Zigia, a 34-year-old from Melbourne with alleged ties to Israel's spy agency Mossad. The reason for his detention remains a mystery. One of the most senior Syrian officials to defect has apparently broken his silence. In a statement, the Syrian government's former spokesman, Jihad Magdisi, said he'd left because his hopes for reform and change had been dashed and there had been no room for moderation. Here's Jim Muir.
Jihad Magdisi was one of the main public faces of the regime, outlining its position at many a news conference. Then suddenly, in early December, he just wasn't there anymore. Unlike a number of high-level defectors, including a prime minister, he did not surface publicly once outside the country or make any statements, and his whereabouts even now remain the subject of uncertainty and speculation. In a statement whose authenticity he confirmed from his Twitter account, Mr. Magdisi said he'd left the regime in a private and independent way because he did not want, as he put it, to be used as a dagger by one side against the other.
The former president of the Maldives, Mohamed Nasheed, has taken refuge in the Indian High Commission in the capital, Male, after a magistrate ordered his arrest for failing to attend a court hearing. Tweeting from the compound, Mr. Nasheed said he was mindful of his own security. He left power last year after a police mutiny. BBC News.
I'm Dave Mattingly with more NPR News. Officials say the Statue of Liberty will reopen to the public by Memorial Day. NPR's Joel Rose reports that pledge is being made by federal officials, along with promises to repair damaged national parks in the New York area.
It's been more than 3 months since Hurricane Sandy slammed into New York and New Jersey, damaging a number of national parks. And it will be another 3 months before the Statue of Liberty reopens to the public. The statue itself came through the storm intact, but the rest of the park sustained extensive damage to pavements, railings, and other structures. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announced that his department will provide $28 million in emergency funding to repair roads and bridges at the Statue of Liberty National Monument, Gateway National Recreation Area, Fire Island National Seashore, and other parks in the region. That should help them reopen in time for the busy summer tourist season. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
No damage or injuries after a moderate earthquake shook parts of Nevada. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake had a magnitude of 5.1. It was centered near the California border, about 200 miles south of Reno. Small aftershocks were also reported. From Heinz Ketchup to Butterball Cold Cuts, 21 companies have met voluntary targets in reducing the amount of salt added to packaged foods. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the goal of the nationwide sodium reduction initiative has been to cut salt in processed foods by 25% with a target date of next year.
About 80% of the sodium in Americans' diets comes from packaged foods or restaurant meals. And public health experts say cutting back salt incrementally may be an effective strategy for reducing the risk of high blood pressure. To this end, makers of some of the most popular packaged foods, such as Kraft Singles cheese slices and Ragu tomato sauce, have managed to reduce sodium about 20% per serving. New York City has been a leader in pushing the initiative, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg says as more companies meet sodium reduction targets, it demonstrates that food companies can make measurable improvements to the healthfulness of the foods that appear on store shelves. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Organizers of the Winter X Games are canceling a snowmobile exhibition planned for next month in France. NPR's Tom Goldman reports a safety review is being done following the death of American snowmobile competitor Caleb Moore.
ESPN puts on the X Games and said in a statement yesterday, "Our review of snowmobile freestyle continues. In the meantime, we've decided to forego the planned demonstration freestyle event at X Games Tignes." Caleb Moore died last month from injuries he suffered when his 450-pound snowmobile rolled on top of him after he performed a mid-air flip and came up short on the landing. Moore is the third athlete in so-called extreme sports to die in the past year in competition or training. It's prompted debate between those who say the sports have gone too far, and many X Games competitors who insist they know the risks and are willing to take them. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
There's a court hearing in Massachusetts today involving reputed Boston gangster James Whitey Bulger. A judge is to hear arguments from the 83-year-old's lawyers that a federal prosecutor granted Bulger immunity to commit crimes while working as an FBI informant. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Charles Schwab, providing retirement options for a tomorrow that's wide open. Learn more at schwab.com/retirement.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News with Linda Wertheimer. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Throughout today's program, we're hearing parts of President Obama's State of the Union address and many reactions to it. This is the part of the program where we take a close read of the speech. We've done this 9 years running. In some cases, we're checking facts, and in other cases, we're asking what some parts of the speech really mean. NPR correspondents will talk us through several key statements, starting with the president's assertion that he's done a lot to reduce the deficit.
We are more than halfway towards the goal of $4 trillion in deficit reduction that economists say we need to stabilize our finances.
NPR's economics correspondent John Inste was listening to that. And John, is that enough?
I think we need to look at the language, Steve. President Obama says $4 trillion in deficit reduction will stabilize the debt. But that suggests he seems to have given up on actually reducing the size of the debt relative to the economy, putting it on a downward trend, much less balancing the federal budget each year. Now, many economists would agree that stabilizing the debt is the first step and gets us out of the danger zone, but others would argue stabilizing the debt at 75% of the size of the economy, where it is right now, is just too high. And the other issue is that the $4 trillion in deficit reduction doesn't include the savings we'll need to make Medicare and Social Security solvent for the long term, so there needs to be another bite of the apple.
Now, at the same time, the president talked about new ideas for spending, or as he would put it, investment. Let's listen.
Tonight, I'll lay out additional proposals that are fully paid for and fully consistent with the budget framework both parties agreed to just 18 months ago. Let me repeat. Nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime.
Trying to drop the dime on spending there. NPR congressional correspondent David Wellner was listening. David, did the rest of the speech measure up to that promise?
Well, Steve, I think the president did not make it at all clear how he would not add a dime to the deficit when he went on to propose a series of big federal investments that will indeed all cost a lot of money. For example, he proposed that Congress create 15 more of the manufacturing innovation hubs, like the one that was started last year in Youngstown, Ohio. He wants high-quality preschool available to every child in America. He did propose a partnership to rebuild America that might attract private capital, but he added he wanted to make sure the taxpayers don't shoulder the whole burden. So there seems to be a suggestion there that there will be some burden. Now, one way to keep these new initiatives from adding a dime to the deficit would be to cut the same amount of spending elsewhere. But if the president's hoping to do that, he did not say so last night.
Okay, that's David Wellner. And let's move on to the health care law, Obamacare, as the president himself now calls it. This is what he said about it.
Already, the Affordable Care Act is helping to slow the growth of health care costs.
Helping to slow the growth of costs. NPR's Julie Robner has been covering this health care law for years. Julie, is the law doing that?
Well, that's certainly what the administration would like people to believe. There isn't a lot of evidence to back it up. Here's what we do know. The growth in healthcare spending over the past couple of years has slowed, and it has slowed a lot. Mostly, analysts think, because of the recession. Now, there's also something else going on at the same time, which is that the way healthcare is delivered has been changing, and it's been changing fast. There's more of an emphasis on delivering care more efficiently. Doctors and hospitals are being organized much differently. And the Affordable Care Act is giving those changes a boost. But to say that it's causing the slower growth in healthcare spending is probably an overreach, at least for now.
Aren't the main changes in this law still supposed to take effect in the future?
Yes, many of them do. And that's certainly one of the major reasons that it is hard to say that this law has been encouraging costs not to go up.
That's NPR's Julie Robner. Now, there's also a difference of fact that was on display last night when it comes to this country's dramatic increase in oil and gas drilling. A lot of that has taken place on private land. The question here has to do with publicly owned land. Let's listen to what the president said.
In fact, much of our newfound energy is drawn from lands and waters that we, the public, own together.
Now, Republicans have for years said the opposite. They blamed the president for blocking exploration on public lands. And in fact, Senator Marco Rubio in the Republican response last night suggested he wanted to change that.
Instead of wasting more taxpayer money on so-called clean energy companies like Solyndra, let's open up more federal lands for safe and responsible exploration.
And we've brought in NPR's Elizabeth Shogren, who covers environmental issues. And Elizabeth, who's right here?
Well, in fact, if you look at the statistics, drilling was up in the U.S. 2011 to 2012 by 25%. So that's a big leap. But if you look at the statistics about drilling on federal land and on federal offshore waters, drilling really wasn't up. And so that shows you that most of the increases are coming on private lands, like the Republicans say. There are, however, lots of possibilities for energy development on federal lands in the future. And there's also this possibility of developing wind power offshore on federal land. So each person has a little bit right.
Now, if you just joined us, we are doing a close read of President Obama's State of the Union speech last night. It came, of course, at a time when there is much talk of changes to immigration law. A key question is border security, and the president made this statement last night.
And we can build on the progress my administration's already made, putting more boots on the southern border than at any time in our history, and reducing illegal crossings to their lowest levels in 40 years.
Their lowest levels in 40 years. NPR's Ted Robbins is in Tucson, Arizona. He covers the border. Ted, why have crossings gone to that low level?
Most experts, Steve, agree that it's the economy. It's the lack of jobs since the recession to bring people here. A lot of people also think that it's so hard to cross now that many of the 11 million people who are in the country without documents used to come and go, they've stayed.
But hard to cross because security is actually increased.
Right. And the fact is that we, by one account, are spending $18 billion this year on border security, agents, equipment, infrastructure. The question is, I think, what we really have to look at here is, when do we get to the point where the border is declared secure? You know, how do we know? The fact is, no one can define what a secure border looks like. The government has been unable to do that, both Bush and Obama administrations, and Congress has been unable to do that. So who decides? And does this really become a trigger for dealing with the other parts of immigration, legalizing those 11 million people, granting more visas, that sort of thing. That trigger is what scuttled immigration reform in 2007, and the Republicans seem to want that again now. That seems to be their precondition.
And let's look closely at one foreign policy statement that the president made last night. He spoke in one passage about the Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings, and their aftermath.
In the Middle East, we will stand with citizens as they demand their universal rights and support stable transitions to democracy.
To which the president added this.
We'll keep the pressure on a Syrian regime that has murdered its own people and support opposition leaders that respect the rights of every Syrian.
Okay, let's bring in NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, who's been closely following that story. And Michelle, what has the president done when it comes to Syria, where there's a civil war that's been going for a couple of years now?
Well, what administration officials will say is that they helped the Syrian opposition get organized, though that's still very much a work in progress. And the U.S. has given a lot of humanitarian aid, though it hasn't been funneling it through the opposition the way the French have, for instance, to boost the credibility of those people inside Syria. And the Obama administration decided against, we now hear, the advice of some of his top advisors, not to arm the opposition, mainly, it seems, to make sure weapons don't fuel the conflict or fall into the hands of extremists. So you hear the president taking quite a cautious approach to Syria and across the region. When he talked about those Arab uprisings last night, he said this process is going to be messy and the U.S. can't dictate change.
Okay, thanks very much. That's NPR's Michelle Kellerman. We also had help on our close read of the President's State of the Union speech from NPR's John Itzde, David Wellna, Ted Robbins, Julie Rovner, and Elizabeth Shogren.
And that was Morning Edition Steve Inskeep with us this morning from Iowa Public Radio. This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the manuscripts dating back to the time of Jesus that were found between 1947 and 1956 in caves by the Dead Sea. Why were they there? Who wrote them? Why were Jews prevented from joining the first panel of scholars interpreting the scrolls? We talk with John Collins, author of The Dead Sea Scrolls, a biography. Join us.
That's on Fresh Air this morning at 9 o'clock, repeated this evening at 6 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. You're listening to Morning Edition. Thursday on Out in the Bay, Phyllis Lyon and the late Del Martin, one of San Francisco's favorite couples, were together 55 years before they were able to legally marry, just months before Del died in 2008. They were the first in a wave of same-sex couples who married during California's brief window before Proposition 8 passed. Valentine's Day was their anniversary. This Valentine's Day, hear their love story and stories of life in San Francisco in the 1950s and 60s. I'm Eric Jansen. Join me out in the Bay Thursday night at 7.
Hi, I'm Chloe Veltman, host of Voicebox, an eclectic exploration of the best of the vocal music scene from the Bay Area and beyond, which airs every Friday night at 10 on KALW. Now, you can hear Voicebox anytime on KALW's local music player, which gives you access to the latest editions of all of KALW's diverse local music programs whenever you want to listen. Just click on the Music tab at kalw.org.
I'm Sandeep Roy. Hear my latest dispatch from Kolkata this morning at 7:35 here on KALW San Francisco.
Sandeep's report from India coming up just 15 minutes from now, part of our presentation of Morning Edition here on KALW 91.7 FM. We're online at kalw.org. It's 7:21.
In last night's State of the Union address, the president touched on the importance of fending off cyber attacks. All this week, we've been reporting on how the U.S. military is prepared to wage cyber war. But it's not just the government that's moving away from a strictly defensive posture. So, too, are some private companies. In the final report in his series, NPR's Tom Gelton reports on companies that think it's time to attack the attackers.
For the first time ever, the CIA and other agencies have prepared a national intelligence estimate on the threat to the United States posed by cyber espionage. The NIE is classified, but it's said to identify China as the leading culprit, and it describes the espionage campaign as massive. That comes as no surprise to U.S. companies who see their networks routinely penetrated and their trade secrets stolen. Many are deeply frustrated over their inability to keep intruders out of their networks. When he was the FBI's top cyber attorney, Stephen Chbosky saw hundreds of U.S. companies being hacked. Then he resigned and went to work as a private cybersecurity expert. His view? Companies spend too much time trying to patch their security holes and defend their networks.
That model needs to reverse itself. Okay, there is no way that we are going to win the cybersecurity effort on defense. We have to go on the offensive.
Chbosky was speaking at a recent conference. He's now the chief risk officer at CrowdStrike, a firm set up to serve companies ready to take the cybersecurity fight to their adversaries. Dmitry Alperovich co-founded CrowdStrike. In an interview, he explained the company philosophy.
You can never win a fight, whether it's in a boxing match, whether it's in a war, by only taking defensive actions, right? If you're just standing up taking blows, the adversary will ultimately hit you hard enough that you will fall to the ground and lose a match. You need to head back.
This idea of fighting back is increasingly popular among companies with assets at risk. Greg Hoagland co-founded H.B. Gary, another firm known for its aggressive approach to cybersecurity. He, too, complains that companies are too slow to confront the people attacking their computer networks.
What we need to do is get rid of the attackers and take away their tools and learn where their hideouts are and flush them out. And that isn't really happening yet in the security space.
This is tough talk. At times, it sounds like these security people are advocating vigilante justice. It's hardly been up to private individuals or firms to get rid of bad guys or flush them out of their hideouts. That's normally the job of law enforcement. But Dmitry Alperovich says the government does little more than warn U.S. companies about the cyber threats they're facing.
It's sort of the equivalent of the government sees a missile heading for your company's headquarters and the government just yells, "Incoming," right? And is doing nothing to prevent it, nothing to stop it, nothing to retaliate against the adversary. That's how the private sector feels today. And until that changes, the private sector is going to take actions into their own hands, and the government shouldn't be surprised about that.
Part of the problem is that the government's jurisdiction in the cybersecurity area is not clear. Some companies don't want the government involved. President Obama yesterday signed an executive order setting out procedures by which the government and the private sector would collaborate in confronting cyber threats. A turn toward more aggressive, more offensive actions against cyber attackers can be risky. In remarks at George Washington University recently, Congressman Mike Rogers, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, reminded companies that they may not know for sure who is attacking them, so counterattacking might not be a good idea.
I'll guarantee you there will be lots of mistakes made, given the sophistication of nation states in hiding their hand in activities. So I worry about the private sector engaging in offensive or active defense, as they call it. I cannot blame them, because if we can't get this framework right, you have an obligation to protect your networks. I get very, very concerned about an unleashed private sector to do active defense, because a lot of things are going to go wrong, I think.
Rogers prefers defense-oriented cybersecurity. He's introducing legislation today that would promote cyber threat information sharing between industry and government. Companies that want to go on offense, striking back at their cyber adversaries, do need to consider the legal risks. Just because you've been hacked doesn't necessarily mean you can hack back. Richard Baitlick is chief security officer at the cyber firm Mandiant.
I've only found one or two lawyers in all the work that I've done over the years who have said, let's consider pursuing some type of offensive response. The corporate legal structure is very conservative when it comes to what we could allow someone to do.
Companies dealing with cyber threats may have to choose between listening to their lawyers and listening to their security people. Baitlick says it may feel good for companies to move aggressively against whoever is hacking them, but he questions whether it's practical.
Most of the lawyers think, look, the data's already been stolen. So if the data's been stolen, what are you going to gain by doing something to the intruder?
Dmitry Alperovich at CrowdStrike is familiar with all the arguments against striking back. He insists there are safe and lawful ways a company can stop an intruder in his tracks and come out ahead.
One thing you can do as a private sector company when they're coming at you is craft a fake negotiation document that they may be after and feed that to them. If they're going after a particular negotiation strategy for a business deal you're involved in and they are on the other side, you feed them a different strategy, you're going to cause them to act in a certain way that's actually going to benefit you.
This is called a honeypot approach. You plant a document in your network that an adversary will find irresistible. But it's a booby trap. The attacker steals the document, takes it home, and boom. In one clever version, the document includes secret code so that when the intruder opens it, it turns the camera on in his computer, takes his picture, and sends it back to you so you can report him to the authorities. Greg Hoagland, the founder of H.B. Gary, says he has reviewed techniques like this with lawyers.
It was pretty clear that putting a booby-trap document in your own network is 100% legal. There's no problem with that. If the bad guy comes and steals it out of your network and opens it in his computer, that's his problem.
Perhaps, but there is still a vigorous debate around what is legal in offensive cyber operations. In the physical world, if you're mugged, you can defend yourself, but you can't track the mugger down a day later and shoot him, nor can you break into his house and get your wallet back. Similar constraints govern in the cyber world. Hoagland recognizes this. He concedes that risks in the offensive approach have to be considered carefully.
This is completely new territory, so a lot of thinking needs to occur around this. Something will change. It'll take its time, but we will see something come out, both from an aspect of what you can do from a self-defense, as well as what kind of policies will be changed to make it so that the attackers will suffer.
Hoagland and other advocates of a harder line against cyber attackers are unlikely to be satisfied by yesterday's executive order. The order requires federal agencies to alert private companies to cyber threats, but it maintains the focus on defense. Companies with critical infrastructure assets like power plants are asked to follow security standards worked out jointly by government and industry. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science, technology, and economics in the modern world. And from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
On the next Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered, I'll be joined by comedian Kurt Bodden. Plus, critic Peter Robinson offers some reviews and a history of, as well as anecdotes for, Valentine's Day on this Valentine's Day edition of Open Air, this Thursday at 1 p.m. I'm David LaTulippe. Join me, won't you?
Open Air, tomorrow afternoon at 1, here on KLW 91.7 FM. It's 7:30.
Good morning, I'm Linda Wertheimer. Republican Senator Marco Rubio delivered the Republican reply to the State of the Union. In mid-critique, Rubio wanted water, but water was out of reach. The senator ducked down, reached off-screen, found it, sipped it, and resumed. But the Twitter sphere had left the building. Water tweets flooded the nation. Rubio tweeted, too, a picture of his water bottle. You're listening to Morning Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. The 10-day manhunt for the fugitive former police officer Christopher Dorner appears to be over. NPR's Amy Walters reports that investigators are now waiting on forensics tests.
Charred human remains were found in a burned-out cabin, the scene of a dramatic shootout and standoff between law enforcement officials and who they believe to be Christopher Dorner. Dorner is suspected in a double homicide and in the shooting of several law enforcement officers while on the run. Yesterday, a state fish and wildlife officer allegedly spotted Dorner in a pickup truck. The truck crashed, and a suspect is said to have fled to the nearby cabin. Fish and Game Lieutenant Patrick Foy.
Of course, the radio call had gone out, and there's a, you know, now the whole world's coming to help.
One sheriff's deputy died of wounds from the shootout. Amy Walters, NPR News.
President Obama is due in Asheville, North Carolina this morning, the first stop of a State of the Union tour that will also take him to Atlanta and Chicago. He is rallying support for a raft of new initiatives unveiled last night, from improving preschool programs, raising the minimum wage, boosting manufacturing, to gun control. NPR's Brian Naylor reports the president struck his most emotional chord last night when talking about reducing gun violence.
The president said overwhelming majorities of Americans approve what he called common sense reform that includes universal background checks and, in his words, getting weapons of war and massive ammunition magazines off our streets.
If you want to vote no, that's your choice. But these proposals deserve a vote.
Victims of gun violence watched the president's speech in the House chamber, including the parents of a 15-year-old Chicago girl slain last month and former Representative Gabrielle Giffords. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
In the Republican response, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida says more government won't help people get ahead.
This opportunity to make it to the middle class or beyond, no matter where you start out in life, it isn't bestowed on us from Washington. It comes from a vibrant free economy where people can risk their own money to open a business. And when they succeed, they hire more people.
Republicans warn President Obama's second-term agenda will bring more tax increases and escalate deficit spending. They are casting the president's policies as impediments to middle-class families. Americans barely spent more last month at retail businesses and restaurants after higher taxes cut their paychecks. A small increase suggests consumer spending may be weak in this first quarter. Analyst Hugh Johnson says the 0.1% rise in retail sales is not bad, actually.
Job gains are offsetting the bad news of tax increases, and that, I think, shows up in this number.
Sales were down at auto dealerships, clothing, and furniture stores. This is NPR News. UN humanitarian relief convoys are, for the first time, reaching rebel-held areas in northern Syria. The Syrian government has allowed the mission, and NPR's Deborah Amos reports residents of one refugee camp are refusing it.
The convoys come from Damascus, a journey of hundreds of miles. The Syrian government agreed to provide aid to rebel-held areas, but also insisted the aid comes from the capital and is distributed by government-approved aid groups. A delivery in the Atma camp, close to the Turkish border, where 20,000 displaced Syrians are short of tents and blankets, was rejected. Angry residents demonstrated and refused to accept help from the government, which they say forced them to flee Air Force bombings. Many humanitarian groups are calling for aid deliveries to come through Turkey. So far, the Syrian government has denied permission for any cross-border aid missions. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Antakya.
Carnival Cruise Line's disabled vessel Triumph is due to arrive under tow in Mobile, Alabama tomorrow. And Sheila Gerganis at the Alabama Cruise Terminal says they'll get the passengers off that ship and on their way back home quickly.
In the past, what we've done is just lined up the buses, and it'll be an easy access out the door of customs with your luggage and get on the bus.
The ship left Galveston, Texas on a four-day cruise last Thursday with more than 4,000 passengers and crew aboard. Then on Sunday, an engine fire knocked out its primary source of power, crippling its water and plumbing systems and leaving it adrift on only backup power. I'm Jean Cochran, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy pajamas delivered overnight and for Valentine's Day at pajamagram.com.
I grew up a bookworm in the dark ages before television really arrived in India. The high point of my cultural calendar was the Kolkata Book Fair. It was always insane. Popular stalls would have to be barricaded against the pressing hordes. The dust they kicked up always gave me a sore throat. But I'd still go every year and come back laden with books from carefully saved pocket money. Mystery stories I wanted were the classics my parents thought I should read, and always some Russian books because those were subsidized by the Soviet Union and very cheap. The Soviet Union has long collapsed, but the book fair is still going strong in its 37th year. This is Sandeep Roy at the Kolkata Book Fair.
There are about 575 stalls and positions in the 37th International Kolkata Book Fair. Apart from that, there are about 200 little magazine stalls.
575 stalls of books, 200 little magazines, over a million people visiting, even a literary meet, pulling in the likes of Thomas Keneally, Amitav Ghosh, and Pico Iyer. But the real high is the amazing sight of people standing in long, winding queues just to get into a bookstall. The sound of a man standing at a doorway, like an old-fashioned carnival barker, inviting you to come in to check out her world of books. Even outside the fairground, there's a little cottage industry of books. There's a man selling, for just 10 rupees, less than 20 cents, a flip book of pictures. A magic book the kids will love, he says. And young men in formal shirt and ties, looking like trainees at some multinational corporation, trying with gallant hopefulness to sell remaindered encyclopedias to a generation that looks for information online.
75% off, sir. 75% off.
I didn't see them sell a single one. But the food stalls were doing very brisk business because book buying needs a lot of tea and coffee as well. The 575 stalls also includes the American Center with a Statue of Liberty trying to exhort people to pay up and become members of the library. And it includes a lot of books on how to develop a super memory, how to help your child succeed, the selected best songs of John Bon Jovi, and Say It Like Obama, a public speaking manual, and an entire stall trying to sell you cost accountancy as a career.
The fees are very reasonable, ranging maximum up to rupees 40,000.
We are offering oral coaching facilities to students in our state-of-the-art classrooms.
But it also comes with little magazines that want to spread the gospel according to Trotsky, one that calls itself Guinea Pig, and another one that's named Ulto Durbin, the reversed telescope. A friend spots strange bedfellows, Gandhi's autobiography right next to Hitler's, and a man sells a 300-year calendar and books that teach you the wonders of English spelling through catchy rhymes. Plowing through aisles and aisles of books selling guides to cracking management exams and microwave cookery, it's easy to wonder if I've been fooled by all those lines into believing in a city that's still enamored of actually reading. Then I walk into a stall that sells somewhat academic titles. A bespectacled young man glances around as he leafs through a book about queer studies in India. I think he's shy about picking up a gay title in public, and then quick as a flash, he's gone. I realize to my shock that he's stolen the book. Then I think, it's not a Seven Steps to Success or Management Secrets book. This was a thief, but a discerning one. And I have to admit, I can't help but feel that perhaps all is not lost yet. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata for KALW.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. It appears to have been a fiery end for a former LAPD officer bent on revenge against his former colleagues. Law enforcement officials here in Southern California believe it was Christopher Dorner who engaged officers in a dramatic gun battle in the mountains east of Los Angeles yesterday and then barricaded himself inside a cabin that later burned to the ground. Charred human remains have been found at the site, but as of late last night, authorities are not confirming that those are the remains of Dorner. He has allegedly killed four people. NPR's Kirk Sigler is at a law enforcement command post in the San Bernardino Mountains. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Okay, so no confirmation that Christopher Dorner is dead, but what do we know?
Well, as you said, the latest is that authorities have found charred human remains at the site of the burned-down cabin. They think that because a suspect matching Dorner's description fled a stolen vehicle near here and took off on foot into the forest to that cabin where he then holed himself up inside. Here's Cindy Bachman of the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office.
We had reason to believe that that was Christopher Dorner because the victims of the car theft said that the suspect that stole their car looked like him, and his actions after stealing the vehicle led us to believe even stronger that it was him. We have not confirmed that it is him.
So the shootout ensued, and then really the dramatic series of events continuing to unfold, with authorities reportedly breaking down windows of the cabin, firing tear gas into it. It's believed they used a loudspeaker to urge the suspect to surrender. Then the cabin caught fire, and there was a report later of a single gunshot being heard. I should say as well that we don't know yet how the cabin caught fire, but it's clear that authorities believe Dorner was in the cabin. They're, of course, still not confirming that. Renee, investigators were at the scene working through the night, and they're not letting us or anyone pass the roadblock here as this investigation is continuing.
So let's back up a bit. Kirk, tell us how this man, who officials suspect was Dorner, got to that cabin.
You know, Renee, it appears Dorner was in these mountains this whole time. You know, even as many had begun to suspect he had fled this area and may have gone even as far as Mexico. It was yesterday around midday that authorities in Big Bear, up the mountain from here, responded to a stolen vehicle, reports of a stolen vehicle and a man driving it who matched Dorner's description. Agents with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife spotted him and begun to trail him. I've got some more tape to play you here from Lieutenant Patrick Foy of the department. He's describing how game wardens came onto the suspect, recognized who he was, and saw him as he was apparently driving erratically.
The suspect rolled his window down, and when the second patrol truck came up with the two wardens inside, that's when he engaged in a shooting with our wardens as they were driving. He did hit the truck multiple times.
From there, Renee, there's really, frankly, still a bit of a hole in this story. The details aren't yet clear, but what we know is that the suspect, matching Dorner's description, later left a vehicle he was in, and authorities trailed him as he took off on foot, as I said, into the forest and holed himself up in that cabin up there.
And, you know, just finally, a very sad note. During the gunfight at the cabin yesterday, two sheriff's deputies were shot. One died. Do you have any details this morning on that?
Yes, both were sheriff's deputies here in San Bernardino County. They were taken down the mountain to Loma Linda Medical Center. One did die. The other was in surgery. Medical personnel say he's expected to survive. You know, later today is a memorial service planned for another slain officer that authorities believe Dorner killed in Riverside last week. It's a reminder of the costs of all of this. Four people dead, two officers now, and also a couple, including the daughter of a man who represented Christopher Dorner when he was dismissed from the LAPD. His dismissal, apparently the trigger that sent him on this killing spree.
Kirk, thanks very much.
Thank you. Glad to do it.
NPR's Kirk Sigler is at a law enforcement command post in the San Bernardino Mountains east of Los Angeles.
In a recent three-month period, U.S. Airlines collected nearly $1 billion just in baggage fees and $650 million in fees from unfortunate passengers who had to change their reservations. Now airlines have still another way of making money on top of the base ticket price. We asked Scott McCartney about it. He is the Wall Street Journal's airline columnist, and he's been writing about these new bundles, which are the subject of today's Business Bottom Line. Scott, good morning.
Good to be with you, Linda.
I wonder if you could give us some examples of bundles we might be offered.
Well, American has started a new bundling where they include Group 1 boarding and a free check bag, round trip, and a waiver of that dastardly domestic change fee that makes everybody crazy. And that's $68 round trip, flat fee. Delta has a bundle that they call Ascend that's priority boarding plus 24-hour Wi-Fi. That's $42, a bit of a discount over what you would get if you buy those separately. Southwest has a new thing where they'll give you early boarding that they sell at the gate, and that's $40 for each flight.
So then, after the airlines very successfully unbundled their services, I mean, did they just turn right around and bundle them up again? Is that where the idea came from?
Yeah, that's right. And I think this was somewhat the intent all along. They unbundled the services, so you had to pay extra to get your bag checked. And now that you have to pay extra to get your bag checked, maybe they can upsell you on, well, let's include that checked bag fee with something else and something else and give you a little bit of a discount over what you would pay to buy all those things separately. It's not all that dissimilar from what car manufacturers do, or, you know, if you go to buy a telephone company with a cell phone plan and television and internet access, and pretty soon you got the whole bundle.
Well, are there any bundles out there that you think might be worth the money?
I'm real pleased to see the extra legroom option. United started this with Economy Plus. Delta has really picked it up and run with it. American is now coming in with it. JetBlue offers extra legroom rows for people who need it, for people who want to be able to work using a laptop computer or something like that. It's a good deal. I'm also intrigued with what American has done with the change fee waiver. As you pointed out, airlines are taking more than $2 billion a year out of consumers in change fees, and it's really kind of outrageous. And so by bundling the option of a change fee waiver with some other things that you might buy normally, the checked bag fee or early boarding, that's an attractive package to a lot of consumers because, you know, life intervenes and plans can change. If you can avoid the penalty for that, that's a good thing.
Are people buying these things, these bundles?
Yeah, I think they are. And I think the important thing here is airlines are really in the infancy in this. They're going to get much better at targeting consumers. And so what you'll find is if you're a business traveler who occasionally buys Wi-Fi, airlines are going to be able to target you when you go to print your boarding pass with the bundles that would include Wi-Fi service. It's really interesting because one of the things that people have complained about with airlines is the nickel and diming effect. So some of the airlines are now sort of bundling this into the fare itself, different classes of fares, to sort of avoid the add-on effect. So you do it on the first screen. And maybe that makes it a little bit less confusing because buying an airline ticket is a complex purchase now, and it used to be pretty simple.
Scott McCartney writes the middle seat column for the Wall Street Journal. Mr. McCartney, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Besides being founders of our republic, what did Thomas Jefferson and George Washington have in common? Answer, hemp. America's founders were strong promoters of this extraordinarily useful agricultural crop, and both Jefferson and Washington grew it. The first draft of our Constitution was written on hemp paper, and as late as World War II, the government urgently pushed farmers to grow the crop as part of a Hemp for Victory program. So why are American farmers today prohibited from producing this patriotic, profitable, and pesticide-free plant? Political nuttiness. Most recently, in a frenzy of reefer madness, U.S. drug police decided that President Nixon's Controlled Substance Act of 1970 not only outlawed marijuana, but also its non-narcotic cousin, industrial hemp. If ignorance is bliss, they must have been ecstatic, yet their nuttiness remains the law of our land. The good news is that a wave of sanity is now wafting across America. In Colorado, for example, farmer Michael Bowman and Denver hemp advocate Linda Parker helped pass Amendment 64 in last fall's election. It legalizes personal pot use, which got all the media attention, but it also directs the legislature to set up a program for, quote, the cultivation, processing, and sale of industrial hemp. Bowman now hopes to be the first American farmer in generations to plant a legal crop of it, hoping to do so on April 30th, the 80th birthday of family farmer hero and hemp champion Willie Nelson. The red state of Kentucky is also on the move. Its Republican Ag Commissioner, backed by its Chamber of Commerce, is campaigning to legalize hemp farming there. And Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is co-sponsoring a national bill with Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden to take hemp off the controlled substance list. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help spread this seed, go to votehemp.com.
It is a scruffy little black pooch named Banana Joe that is now America's new top dog. Joe, an Affin Pinscher, won Best in Show last night in New York at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. Josh Dean is author of the book Show Dog, and he joined us to talk about the results. Good morning.
Good morning.
So a lot of people may not know what an Affin Pinscher actually is. Why don't you describe the breed for us?
That often happens at Westminster. It's a small, fuzzy-faced German dog. It's actually one of the older toy breeds, and it looks like it looks terrier-like, but it's actually not out of the terrier group. Definitely not in your most popular breeds. I think it's somewhere in the 120s in terms of popularity here in America.
Well, I gather they call it, some people call it affectionately, a monkey dog.
The Affin, apparently, I don't speak German, but means monkey, or at least is the same root. So basically, yeah, it's named a monkey face dog because it's unquestionable. If you look at that dog's face, you think, that's not a dog, that's a monkey.
Well, all right. Well, tell us, they often get these cute dogs who end up being best in show. Well, tell us about this one, Banana Joe.
He's actually a very successful dog. He was a big champion in Europe before he came to America. And last year, he was considered to be one of the favorites. So this wasn't a really big surprise to dog show people. And I think that he became one of the favorites with the crowd, too, because he does have an adorable face. And he's got a lot of personality, as little dogs often do.
Well, I also hear that what you might call the real story of the night is a dog that came in second.
Swagger. Yeah, this is the dog that really, I don't know if it's fair to say captured America's imagination, because that would, I guess, imply that most of America was watching. But it definitely, the crowd fell in love with that dog.
And he's what?
He's
what breed?
He's an old English sheepdog. And he is out of Colorado Springs. And this is as close as you'll ever see at Westminster to an out-of-nowhere, just regular old dog. Now, I say that, of course, this is a highly bred show dog, and his owners wouldn't have brought him to Westminster if they didn't think he had a chance to do well. But this is the first year Westminster's allowed what they call class dogs, which are dogs that are not yet champions. So he'd only entered three dog shows in his life. Westminster was his fourth. His owners decided to bring him out from Colorado, entered him, and he beat all of the country's best sheepdogs, and then he beat all of the country's best herding dogs. And then suddenly there he was last night in Best in Show against some of the most expensive dogs in the country, dogs that have been shown for years and years. And he was definitely getting the biggest cheers, and I started to let myself believe for a minute that there was a chance he could win.
Yeah, like a Cinderella story.
Oh, complete Cinderella story. It would have been, there would be, movie rights would probably already be sold.
Well, okay, he didn't win. Banana Joe did. But does Banana Joe's victory mean we're going to see more of his breed, the monkey-faced dog breed?
You definitely see, every year there is a Westminster effect. So I think you'll see a few more of them, but not to the degree of, for instance, when Uno the Beagle won a few years ago, and Beagle already being a popular breed. And I think that reminded people how much they loved those dogs. So I wouldn't necessarily look for Affin Pinschers all over your park next year.
All right. Well, Josh Dean is author of the book Show Dog, talking to us about the winner of last night's Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. Thanks much.
Thank you.
From the love of dogs to some thoughts now about Cupid and the world of sports. Here's commentator Frank DeFord.
Gentlemen of a certain age might make a nostalgic note that today, Valentine's Eve, is the 80th birthday of Kim Novak. One of Miss Novak's most famous movie roles was in Picnic, where she played the gorgeous ingenue who could have married the son of the richest man in town, but instead fell for a hunk of a bum who was an old football star. Picnic is being revived on Broadway, as is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, where, guess what? Maggie, the beautiful Scarlett Johansson, is married to a hunk of a bum who is a former football star. I bring this up especially because last month, Brent Musburger, doing play-by-play for ESPN, was pilloried for allegedly being sexist because he gushed how Miss Alabama was going out with the Alabama quarterback. Of course she is. If Mr. Musburger was guilty of anything, it was failing to note what a cliché he was dealing in. As Tennessee Williams and William Inge and scores of lesser writers have written, it is all so true. Beautiful women fall for athletes, especially football stars, most especially quarterbacks. If football had been around in Shakespeare's time, the bard would have had Juliet ditch Romeo for Flacco. Dare I say it? Flacco, Flacco, wherefore art thou Flacco? Where have you been, critics of Brent Musburger? Going back before Jane Russell fell for Bob Waterfield, through Joe Namath, and on past Tom Brady, pretty ladies have thrown themselves at field generals. But we seem to have a new trend this Valentine's. More and more, athletes are falling in love with athletes. Why, Danica Patrick is actually going out with a competitor race driver, Ricky Stenhouse Jr. The number one golfer in the world, Rory McIlroy, is canoodling with Caroline Wozniacki, who used to be the number one tennis player. Love seems to have worked better for the golfer. He went to the top of the rankings after the romance started, while Ms. Wozniacki nosedived. Give her a ring, Rory. After all, another top tennis player, Maria Karolinko, recently became engaged to Alex Ovechkin, one of the best hockey players in the world, and Maria's been on a tear ever since Alex proposed. And now comes the news that Tiger Woods, who rather famously or infamously prefers blondes, is at least good friends with Lindsey Vonn, the great skier. When she had a terrible accident on the Austrian slopes last week, the gallant Mr. Woods sent his private plane to fetch her, sort of the modern equivalent of Sir Walter Raleigh spreading his cape in the puddle for Her Majesty. There have been a few all-athletic romances in the past, Ralph Kiner and Nancy Chaffee, Andre Agassi and Steffi Graf, Florence Griffin and Al Joyner, but perhaps especially now that there are so many more female athletes, sports stars are connecting in the workplace just like everybody else. However, even at Valentine's, quarterbacks still seem to prefer beauty queens, and vice versa.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us every Wednesday. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, a national network of five cancer hospitals dedicated to helping patients fight advanced stage cancer. More at cancercenter.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. And from Vermont Teddy Bear, offering the 4.5-foot-tall Big Hunk of Love Bear, delivered overnight and for Valentine's Day, at VermontTeddyBear.com. This is NPR.
Tune into Cross Currents today at 5. We'll live through the harrowing experience of searching for a bone marrow donor.
We were told that he needed a bone marrow transplant to cure this cancer, and that we needed to push and to find a match. And we did the searches through the international bone marrow registries, and we did not find a match.
That's today at 5 on Cross Currents.
Cross Currents, 5 o'clock this afternoon here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco. Programming on KLW is supported in part by the Stanford Storytelling Project, presenting Community of the Heart, a special evening with poet Coleman Barks and storyteller Martin Shaw this Friday, February 15th at 7:30 p.m. at Stanford Memorial Church. The event is free and open to the public. For more information, go to storytelling.stanford.edu. Coming up at 8 o'clock, one more hour of Morning Edition is just ahead. Then at 9 o'clock, it's Fresh Air.
Good morning. The most dramatic moment of the State of the Union address, the president's impassioned plea for tougher gun laws as victims of gun violence looked on Morning Edition from NPR News.
President Obama called for a higher minimum wage plus doing more to tackle climate change. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We get reaction from Republican and Democratic lawmakers to the president's speech, which touched briefly on the civil war in Syria. NPR's Deborah Amos reports on how humanitarian aid is now getting to a big refugee camp in a rebel-held area. Plus, the story of a fitness instructor who's 73 years old. That begins our series on aging workers. It's Wednesday, February 13th. Chuck Yeager, the first test pilot to break the sound barrier, is 90. News is next.
BBC News with Ian Purden. The United States and the European Union say they plan to start talks by the end of June on the world's largest bilateral trade deal. The aim is to cut import tariffs and regulations in a way that could set a standard for global trade liberalisation. The EU Trade Commissioner said he hoped a deal could be reached within 2 years. Here's Gavin Hewitt.
EU officials are describing it as a game changer, which over time would boost growth and jobs. It would add 0.5% to the EU economy every year once the deal was in place. There will be difficult areas, agreeing market access and removing tariff barriers, and one of the hardest questions to settle will be over agriculture. Both America and Europe strongly defend their farming sectors. These negotiations will not be easy, acknowledged EU officials. President Obama says the trade, which is free and fair across the Atlantic, will support millions of good-paying American jobs.
Pope Benedict has been applauded by thousands of worshippers at the Vatican in his first public appearance since the announcement of his resignation. He said he was fully conscious of the gravity of his decision to step down. He's the first pope to do so for six centuries. Here's Alan Little.
It was his traditional Wednesday audience, normally a routine affair, but infused this Wednesday with great symbolic significance. Thousands packed the audience hall and gave him a minute-long standing ovation before he spoke. Looking frail and speaking softly, he said he had taken the decision to resign after examining his conscience before God. He had done it in full freedom and for the good of the Church. Many of those listening had tears in their eyes. The initial shock that greeted his decision on Monday has given way to a mood of affection and sadness among those gathered here. This most traditional of popes ends his ministry in the most unexpected and least traditional of ways.
Australia's Foreign Minister Bob Carr has ordered a review of how diplomats handled the detention of an Australian man believed to have killed himself in an Israeli maximum security prison in 2010. An investigation by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation identified the man, previously known only as Prisoner X, as Ben Zigia, a 34-year-old from Melbourne with alleged ties to Israel's spy agency Mossad. This from Yolande Nell.
Gag orders are rarely used in Israel. However, when they are imposed, they're taken very seriously. As ABC prepared to air its report in Australia, Israeli media editors were apparently asked to withhold information that was embarrassing to a certain government agency. In the end, though, the international dimension to this case made it hard to keep secret. And members of the Israeli parliament asked the justice minister difficult questions that led to a partial lifting of media restrictions.
World News from the BBC. Afghan officials say a NATO airstrike in eastern Kunar province has killed 10 civilians, half of them children. Four Taliban commanders were also killed in the attack, which was aimed at one of their hideouts in the Shigal district. One of the most senior Syrian officials to defect has apparently broken his silence. In a statement, the Syrian government's former spokesman, Jihad Makdisi, said he'd left because his hopes for reform and change had been dashed and there'd been no room for moderation. Here's Jim Muir.
Jihad Makdisi was one of the main public faces of the regime, outlining its position at many a news conference. Then suddenly, in early December, he just wasn't there anymore. Unlike a number of high-level defectors, including a prime minister, he did not surface publicly once outside the country or make any statements, and his whereabouts even now remain the subject of uncertainty and speculation. In a statement whose authenticity he confirmed from his Twitter account, Mr. Makdisi said he'd left the regime in a private and independent way because he did not want, as he put it, to be used as a dagger by one side against the other.
French troops in the Malian town of Gao have seized 500 kilos of liquid fertilizer, which they believe was being used by Islamist militants to make bombs. Wires and ammunition were also recovered from a house in Gao, which was identified as a bomb factory by French and Malian government troops when they recaptured the town from Islamist When they recovered the town from Islamist rebels 2 weeks ago. Right, before I fall apart completely, Ukraine's emergency agency says that part of a building has collapsed at the defunct Chernobyl nuclear plant. It says radiation levels there are within the norm, but French construction staff working at the plant have been evacuated as a precaution. That's the latest BBC News. More, of course, on our website.
I'm Dave Mattingly with more NPR News. Officials say the Statue of Liberty will reopen to the public by Memorial Day. NPR's Joel Rose reports that pledge is being made by federal officials, along with promises to repair damaged national parks in the New York area.
It's been more than 3 months since Hurricane Sandy slammed into New York and New Jersey, damaging a number of national parks, and it will be another 3 months before the Statue of Liberty reopens to the public. The statue itself came through the storm intact, but the rest of the park sustained extensive damage to pavements, railings, and other structures. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announced that his department will provide $28 million in emergency funding to repair roads and bridges at the Statue of Liberty National Monument, Gateway National Recreation Area, Fire Island National Seashore, and other parks in the region. That should help them reopen in time for the busy summer tourist season. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
No damage or injuries after a moderate earthquake shook parts of Nevada. The U.S. Geological Survey says the quake had a magnitude of 5.1. It was centered near the California border, about 200 miles south of Reno. Small aftershocks were also reported. From Heinz Ketchup to Butterball Cold Cuts, 21 companies have met voluntary targets in reducing the amount of salt added to packaged foods. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the goal of the nationwide sodium reduction initiative has been to cut salt in processed foods by 25% with a target date of next year.
About 80% of the sodium in Americans' diets comes from packaged foods or restaurant meals. And public health experts say cutting back salt incrementally may be an effective strategy for reducing the risk of high blood pressure. To this end, makers of some of the most popular packaged foods, such as Kraft Singles cheese slices and Ragu tomato sauce, have managed to reduce sodium about 20% per serving. New York City has been a leader in pushing the initiative, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg says as more companies meet sodium reduction targets, it demonstrates that food companies can make measurable improvements to the healthfulness of the foods that appear on store shelves. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Organizers of the Winter X Games are canceling a snowmobile exhibition planned for next month in France. NPR's Tom Goldman reports a safety review is being done following the death of American snowmobile competitor Caleb Moore.
ESPN puts on the X Games and said in a statement yesterday, "Our review of snowmobile freestyle continues. In the meantime, we've decided to forego the planned demonstration freestyle event at X Games Tignes." Caleb Moore died last month from injuries he suffered when his 450-pound snowmobile rolled on top of him after he performed a mid-air flip and came up short on the landing. Moore is the third athlete in so-called extreme sports to die in the past year in competition or training. It's prompted debate between those who say the sports have gone too far, and many X Games competitors who insist they know the risks and are willing to take them. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
There's a court hearing in Massachusetts today involving reputed Boston gangster James Whitey Bulger. A judge is to hear arguments from the 83-year-old's lawyers that a federal prosecutor granted Bulger immunity to commit crimes while working as an FBI informant. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, proud sponsor of StoryCorps, celebrating American stories and American lives. KALW receives 3/4 of its budget directly from listeners like Paula Kupke of San Francisco. If you've recently discovered KALW, please consider becoming a member today at KALW.org. It's 10 minutes past 8.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. You can tell what the president had as his top priority in last night's State of the Union address by where he'll be this morning, an auto parts factory in North Carolina, highlighting his plan to encourage more manufacturing in America. Mr. Obama also called for a higher minimum wage and universal preschool education as part of a broader agenda to strengthen the middle class. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
The White House seemed surprised that last month's inaugural address was characterized in some quarters as a liberal manifesto. So last night's State of the Union speech was firmly grounded in the bread-and-butter pocketbook issues facing the middle class.
Every day, we should ask ourselves three questions as a nation. How do we attract more jobs to our shores? How do we equip our people with the skills they need to get those jobs? And how do we make sure that hard work leads to a decent living?
Obama urged Congress not to jeopardize the economic recovery by allowing automatic government spending cuts to take effect next month. He said while reducing the deficit is important, it's not by itself an economic plan. Some of the plans the president spelled out last night were familiar, recycled from previous years: tax reform, institutes for manufacturing, increased spending on public works. New proposals include rewards for high schools that offer real-world job training and a plan to offer every four-year-old high-quality preschool.
We know this works. So let's do what works and make sure none of our children start the race of life already behind. Let's give our kids that chance.
The president also called for raising the federal minimum wage so as to match the buying power the wage had in the Reagan administration. He also says the minimum wage should rise automatically along with the cost of living.
Let's declare that in the wealthiest nation on earth, no one who works full-time should have to live in poverty, and raise the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour.
Most of the proposals did not come with specific price tags attached, but Obama insists his plans would not add to the deficit, not even by a dime.
It is not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth.
As usual, foreign policy took a back seat in the address. The president confirmed that about half the U.S. troops in Afghanistan will withdraw this year, with most of the rest leaving in 2014. He also promised to do what's necessary to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon, a point he'll underscore when he visits Israel next month. Closer to home, the president said he's forming a commission to address the long lines that plagued voting last November. And even in the midst of an oil and gas boom, he said America must continue to pursue cleaner forms of energy.
For the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change.
If Congress refuses to act on greenhouse gases, the president says he will. That could mean new EPA regulations on existing power plants. Congressional action seems more likely in the area of immigration, in part because of Republican losses among Latino voters last fall. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who gave the Republican response last night, is part of a bipartisan group of senators working to draft a new immigration law. Outside of immigration, though, Rubio and the president don't agree on much.
More government isn't going to help you get ahead. It's going to hold you back. More government isn't going to create more opportunities. It's going to limit them. And more government isn't going to inspire new ideas, new businesses, and new private sector jobs. It's going to create uncertainty.
The emotional climax of the president's speech came when he addressed gun violence. There were dozens of people in the audience who'd been victims of gunfire. Obama says lawmakers owe it to them to act.
The families of Newtown deserve a vote. The families of Aurora deserve a vote. The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
On this and other issues, the president seems confident that a majority of Americans agree with him, even if congressional Republicans and their voters do not. He argues those Republicans should vote no if they want, but should also allow the proposals to come to the floor for a vote. Disagreement is okay, he seems to suggest. Dysfunction and stalemate are not. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Also watching the president's address last night was NPR congressional correspondent Tamara Keith. She was in the chamber and spoke to members of Congress afterwards.
president started talking about gun violence, former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and her family stood up. They were among many victims and survivors of gun violence seated in the galleries overlooking the chamber, wearing green ribbons in honor of the Newtown shooting that killed 20 first graders. Carolyn Murray stood holding a picture of her teenage son, who was gunned down last year. She was there as a guest of Democratic Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from Illinois.
I looked up as the president was talking about actually calling a vote, and I saw her tears running down her face. She was crying, believing, I think, that finally something would be done.
That one moment.
New York Democrat Steve Israel.
Where the president talked about the families of victims of gun violence deserving a vote was one of the most emotional moments that I've ever seen at a State of the Union. And I hope that we can translate that emotion into some common sense reforms of our gun laws.
Just what makes sense, common or otherwise, is still up for debate.
The truth is, all of us are moved in our heart on this issue.
Trent Franks is a Republican congressman from Arizona.
We all desperately want to protect our children, and yet I saw almost nothing there that would actually protect them. I saw an attack on the Second Amendment.
And this isn't just a Democrat versus Republican thing. Take Joe Manchin, a Democratic senator from West Virginia.
You know, it's a very difficult issue.
He talks about keeping guns out of the hands of those who shouldn't have them and addressing mental illness.
We want to make sure that we do everything we possibly can to consider everyone's concerns, but also fix things.
The path from emotional moment to law, or even real live legislation, remains unclear. But prospects appear to be brighter on another front, immigration. There may have been only a half dozen times all night when both sides of the aisle all stood and clapped in approval. One of those moments was when President Obama called for comprehensive immigration reform. Raul Labrador, a Republican congressman from Idaho, says that's something he wants.
I've always said that this is the one issue where maybe Republicans need to be a little bit softer. You know, there's other areas like the budget, spending, all those areas where I think we need to stand firmly on our conservative principles. But I think on immigration, we can actually move, and we have moved.
Oklahoma Republican Congressman James Lankford was part of the group of lawmakers who escorted the president into the chamber.
In the side room, he and I were talking, and two or three of us, and he asked that same question, how do we move things? I said, we need to find the small things we can agree on and move them.
When asked to name a few such things, Lankford didn't talk about guns or immigration or any of the other items in the headlines this morning. He talked about strengthening families and making natural gas drilling easier, both of which were mentioned in the speech. But before Congress and the president can get to any of those things, there's another pressing fiscal deadline. Automatic across-the-board spending cuts worth $1 trillion over a decade are set to hit March 1st. The president called on Congress to find a reasonable, less damaging alternative to these cuts, which are called the sequester. In the Tea Party response last night, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul suggested the opposite.
Not only should the sequester stand, many pundits say the sequester's far short, that we need $4 trillion in cuts.
That's a measure of the gulf between the parties and the likelihood the sequester will start 2 weeks from Friday. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News.
Do you want to go into business for yourself but worry that you'll end up alone in your office, which is actually your kitchen table, with a phone that never rings, a website no one clicks, and a bank balance of $3.50? If so, KALW San Francisco is sponsoring an event you won't want to miss. I'm Lisa Rothman, host of Chew On This, and on Friday the 15th at 12:30, we'll be taping our next show at the Soma Street Food Park at 11th Street and Division in San Francisco, and we want you to be in the audience. Sure, you can come on a Friday. You stop working for the man. We'll have experts ready to answer your questions about how to strike out on your own. The recording starts at 12:30, but come early to grab some lunch. All ages are welcome as Chew On This comes to the Soma Street Food Park in San Francisco Friday the 15th at 12:30. For more information, head to kalw.org.
How do we grieve?
On the next Juror Call, we'll have a conversation with Megan O'Rourke, author of the memoir, The Long Goodbye. She says most Westerners are uncomfortable around death, and the rituals that once guided mourners and communities have mostly disappeared. So what is grief? And what is it like to mourn when there are so few rituals for observing and externalizing grief? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. How have you coped with the death of a loved one? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.
Your Call coming up at 10 o'clock this morning here on 91.7 FM. At 9 o'clock, it's Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Programming on KLW is supported in part by SF Jazz, presenting Season 1 at the SF Jazz Center, including Tony Bennett, McCoy Tyner, Bill Frisell, Bela Fleck, Dave Holland, Zakir Hussain, Jason Moran, Diane Reeves, and Brad Meldo. Information and song clips are available online at sfjazz.org. It's 21 minutes past 8 o'clock, 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco. Back to Morning Edition.
Retirement isn't what it used to be, or even when it used to be. Increasingly, people are continuing to work past the age of 65. In fact, government statistics show that almost a third of Americans between the ages of 65 and 70 are still working. Even among people 75 or older, 7% are still on the job. We're exploring this phenomenon in a new series called Working Late. NPR's Ina Jaffe covers aging, and over the next few weeks, she'll be introducing us to several older adults still in the workforce. Ina is here in the studio at NPR West with me. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I would think this is a baby boomer phenomenon. We all know boomers, we can include ourselves in this one, never plan to get old.
You know, Renee, it's not really a boomer phenomenon. If you think about it, the oldest baby boomers have just begun reaching retirement age in the past year or two. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics says this trend actually started long ago. Since the late 1970s, the percentage of Americans over 65 who are still working has doubled. And those numbers are going to swell as the baby boomers hit 65.
Why, then, are people working later? I mean, we know hard times. Some people, of course, have to. But also what? Because some want to?
Well, both, really. I mean, some can't afford to retire, as you pointed out. They may not have saved enough, or they may have lost money from retirement savings during the recession. But maybe the biggest reason that older people are still working is that they can. People are living longer and staying healthy longer, and a lot of them want to keep working.
Which brings us to the story that you have for us today, which I gather is about someone whose job actually keeps him healthy and active.
And it keeps a lot of other people healthy and active, too. His name is John David. He's 73 years old, and he's a fitness instructor for people over 60.
You got your weights, you got the chair.
This is David's class at the 92nd Street Y in New York.
Twisting just the torso, not the legs, not the head. Twist. Take a deep breath and hold. I'm counting to 100.
There are more than 30 people here, enough to pack the room. Over the course of this hour, sometimes sitting, sometimes standing, they will stretch and flex every single part of their bodies.
Watch what I'm doing.
John David doesn't just tell, he shows, going through every movement with his class. He teaches two classes a day, then he goes through the workout twice. And he looks up to it. He's tall and lean, just the way you'd picture someone who spent decades as a runner and a gym rat.
Down here. Back here.
At this moment, everyone in class is on their feet, bouncing, moving their arms, shaking their hips.
If I screw up, just keep on.
They stand on one leg, extending the other to the front, back, and sides. Some hold on to the backs of their chairs. Some don't need to. Looks kind of like a freeform hokey-pokey without the circle. Everyone is smiling, which keeps John David happy.
This turned out to be the real calling. This turned out to be the thing I am good at. And you can see that people respond, so it's rewarding.
This wasn't always David's calling. He used to live in Los Angeles and work in TV production. He was also spending a lot of time in the gym, and he noticed something about the people there.
If you were pretty, if you were handsome, and you were fit, you got a lot of help from the trainers. A lot of help. And if you were funny looking, or overweight, or awkward, or had gray hair, not so much. And I thought, the people who need the stuff are not getting it.
So in his mid-50s, David decided to become a certified trainer. He was looking to get out of television anyway.
He tried to get a job at his gym.
They said, "We're not hiring right now." Well, 2 or 3 days later, they hired somebody, but they were young.
So David started out volunteering in retirement communities until it turned into paying work. By the time he moved to New York 15 years ago, he had a resume. He now teaches at several community centers around Manhattan. He also has a few private clients. It's not full-time work, and he doesn't make a lot of money, but he loves being able to give older adults what they need from a fitness routine. In fact, at 73 years of age, David's given up on running. The routine he teaches is now his primary workout.
I take it from my own experience. The things that you need at my age, the things that you need are entirely different than what you need when you're 35 and, you know, you're thinking about your beach body and sexual prowess or whatever.
For people in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, exercise is about something much more fundamental.
Can I live my life? Can I get out of a chair? Can I walk to the store? Can I be the person I want to be?
You seem to have gone through, made a concerted effort to go through every single muscle group, including face muscles, including eye muscles.
Everything's got to work.
Every body part.
Every body part, particularly your eyes. And moving your neck. And when you go out in the street, you have to turn your head. You want to see that pizza delivery guy on the bike. You want to see the cab coming.
David's students know that they're being taught by one of their own. 93-year-old Mimi Rockmore has been in David's class about a year.
I like it that he's older, that he understands what hurts and what doesn't.
And they know that exercise can help them hang on to what they've got and keep the bad stuff from getting worse, whether it's improving endurance or fighting osteoporosis or staying mentally sharp. 99-year-old Sid Kreps knows what he gets out of the class.
Tighter muscles.
You feel stronger?
I keep on holding to the strength that I have. I don't know that I feel stronger. I feel strong enough.
John David intends to keep teaching his classes as long as he's strong enough.
And I don't know how long it will work, but I'll do it as long as I can. As long as I think I'm having an effect, having a good effect.
That's 73-year-old fitness instructor John David. And I know just one thing. John David doesn't seem to plan on retiring ever unless something forces him to. Is that what you found with other people that you've interviewed for this series?
Not with all of them, Renee. I interviewed one woman who did retire. She was really looking forward to it. She had other passions she wanted to pursue. But she suffered some big financial losses during the recession, and she had to keep working. And we're going to meet her next week.
That's NPR's Ina Jaffe, who is reporting a series over the next few weeks here on Morning Edition. We're calling Working Late. We'd like to hear your stories about people who are staying in the workforce beyond the traditional retirement years. You can tell us more at npr.org/workinglate. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Ally Bank, who believes in getting more from your news and your money, offering money market accounts. Learn more at allybank.com. From The Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy pajamas delivered overnight and for Valentine's Day at pajamagram.com. And from Clear Choice Dental Implant Centers, offering dental implants designed to function like natural teeth. Learn more at clearchoice.com. This is NPR.
Tonight on the Fog City Blues.
The mouth harp is the harmonica. The hoot stick is the harmonica. The Mississippi saxophone is the harmonica.
Music and conversation with Mark Lempert, director of Pocketful of Soul, the harmonica documentary.
I mean, this thing is everywhere. It's in their breakfast cereals. It's in their hygiene products. It's in their cars. It's all over the world.
It's the Fog City Blues Harmonica Special, tonight at 9 on KALW 91.7.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. In New York, it's hard to get a dinner reservation to a trendy restaurant on Valentine's Day. And apparently for hipsters in Brooklyn's Greenpoint neighborhood, it can be tough to get a spot on a romantic tour of a sewage treatment plant. New York's Department of Environmental Protection says this Valentine's Day it had to add an extra tour because of the demand. Why the sewage plant tour is so trendy? Maybe the pheromones. It's Morning Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. President Obama is following up his State of the Union address with a trip to North Carolina this morning. NPR's Giles Snyder reports he'll be talking about strengthening the middle class.
The president will be in Asheville, North Carolina, visiting a factory that makes automobile components. He's expected to focus on plans he laid out to bring back manufacturing jobs.
It is our generation's task, then, to reignite the true engine of America's economic growth.
The president wants to spend $1 billion to create a network of 15 manufacturing institutes around the country to teach new skills. He'll need congressional approval for most of them, but he plans to create three on his own. Asheville is the first stop at a three-day tour. He'll travel to Atlanta on Thursday and Chicago on Friday. Giles Snyder, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama's nominee for Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, is urging Congress not to allow automatic spending cuts to go into effect on March 1st. Lew is telling the Senate Finance Committee in prepared remarks that the $85 billion in cuts would impose self-inflicted wounds to the recovery and put far too many jobs and businesses at risk. Lew is expected to win Senate confirmation, but probably not until after Congress returns from its week-long recess on the 25th. The San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office is waiting for results of forensics tests, but they believe the charred remains found inside a cabin in the Big Bear Lake community are that of fugitive Christopher Dorner. The search for the former Los Angeles police officer ended yesterday when a man believed to be Dorner bolted from hiding, stole two cars, then barricaded himself in a vacant cabin and engaged in a shootout. One sheriff's deputy was killed, another wounded in that shootout before the building erupted in flames. Dorner was accused of killing three people last week. Retail sales ticked up by 0.1% last month for the smallest increase in 3 months. But NPR's Dan Bobkoff reports the payroll tax hike did not derail spending.
Despite higher gas prices and a 2% higher payroll tax, shoppers spent a hair more, 0.1% more, in January versus December. Russell Price is senior economist at Ameriprise Financial. He says some thought sales might decline, so today's report suggests Americans are feeling better about the economy.
They see the value of their home rebounding. They see the stock market going up. So people have a better feeling about their financial situation personally, so maybe they're a little bit more willing to spend.
It was not all good news. Car dealers, clothing shops, and furniture retailers saw sales fall last month. Home improvement stores and some retail chains did better. Dan Bobkoff, NPR News, New York.
Slower restocking of store shelves was a major drag on the economy in the final 3 months of last year. Business inventories ticked up just 0.1% in December. This is NPR News. It was a solid show of bipartisanship as the Senate voted to renew and expand the Violence Against Women Act. Here's NPR's David Wellner.
The Senate reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act keeps it funded for the next 5 years, although with 17% less money. Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy hailed the bill's passage.
It'd be almost impossible to vote no on this bill. Will this stop all violence? No. But will it stop a lot of it? Yes.
Every Democrat voted for the bill, as did 23 Republicans. 22 Republicans opposed it, including the five men on the GOP leadership team. At issue was a provision giving tribal courts jurisdiction over non-Native American men accused of abusing women on reservations. The House has not taken up similar legislation. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
In southern New England, some schools are still closed, some cars are still buried, and streets still blocked by snow left from last weekend's big storm. So officials around the region are asking people to pick up a shovel and help out. That has Pedro Gonzalez in Cranston, Rhode Island, out clearing snow from his elderly neighbor's driveway.
I have a mom who's old, and if I was in Iran, I would appreciate if someone would come over and help her.
In Boston, it's a snow angel campaign using social media to encourage neighbors and friends to help dig out the stranded. Hundreds of volunteers carried shovels to downtown Waterbury, Connecticut, after the mayor promised to pay minimum wage to anyone who helps clear the city hall area and schools. And by this morning, more than 6,800 utility customers were still without power. I'm Jean Cochran, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Microsoft. Bing, featuring people's real-time reactions to last night's State of the Union address at bing.com/politics.
The political crisis in Tunisia is deepening after the murder of a prominent secular politician last week. Tunisians are increasingly divided over their country's government and future, just 2 years after collectively overthrowing a dictator in a popular revolution. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is following events in the capital, Tunis, and sent this report.
The murder of outspoken politician Shoukry Belaid shocked Tunisians to their core. Tens of thousands of people turned out to bury him Friday in Tunis's main cemetery. The much-beloved human rights lawyer was well known for defending the poor and even Islamists jailed under the regime of dictator Ben Ali. But secular Tunisians say the moderate Islamist government had a hand in Belaid's death because it didn't crack down on the extremists who they say killed him. As Belaid was laid to rest, mourners broke into the national anthem and called for a second revolution to throw out the Islamist government. Being here, one has the sense that secular Tunisia will prevail over religious Tunisia. But summing up the country's problems in terms of secularists versus Islamists is too simplistic, says Monica Marks, who's writing her Oxford University doctoral thesis on Tunisia. Marks says such an analysis misses many other important issues.
One big problem that Shoukry Belaid's murder highlighted was the weak security sector in Tunisia. We need forensics. We need clear investigations. We need rule of law. And all of those things are very difficult to implement in a country that was dominated by the old informant system, the old Mukhabarat system, the secret police.
Marx says the Islamist-led government has the unenviable task of fixing security, the economy, and everything else after 50 years of dictatorship and under the current climate of instability. Over the weekend, Islamist supporters of the government took to the streets. People here, like Habibi Awili, also condemned Belaid's murder, but they say the democratically elected government is in no way responsible.
We need time. This is the difficulties of dictator of 50 years ago. So we cannot solve in one day or 1 year. We believe that Tunisian people and this government, honest, they are going in the real democracy.
Protesters are also angry at former colonial ruler France. They chanted French out in response to a French minister's warning that Islamist fascism could be on the rise in Tunisia. France is against our democratic choice because France is against Muslims in general, says this man. Protesters also accused the killers, whoever they are, of trying to pit Tunisians against each other. True or not, it seems to be working.
Vive la Tunisie! Vive la Tunisie!
Long live Tunisia, yells one frustrated demonstrator. Monica Marks says Tunisians of all colors are frightened that their revolution is being stolen.
This is a revolution that people care for strongly. It's their revolution. It is a Tunisian revolution. It's not a revolution of the Islamists or the secularists or rich people or poor people or young people or old people. It's everyone's revolution. So the biggest fear, more than anything, is going back to the old regime or having any one group dominate this revolution.
Some demonstrators say the problem is not the people, but the political class. Politicians, they say, need to put their own interests aside and focus on what's best for the country. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Tunis.
This is NPR News.
And this is KLW San Francisco, 91.7 FM. Programming on KLW is supported in part by the Stanford Storytelling Project, presenting Community of the Heart, a special evening with poet Coleman Barks and storyteller Martin Shaw. It's this Friday, February 15th, 7:30 p.m. at Stanford Memorial Church. The event is free and open to the public. For more information, go to storytelling.stanford.edu. You're listening to Morning Edition on 91.7 KALW.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. For the first time, truckloads of tents, food, and blankets from the UN have reached Syria's largest refugee camp in a rebel-controlled area. Millions of Syrians have fled their homes to escape the violence. Now it's cold and hunger that threaten their lives. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad actually approved the mission, which is why, as NPR's Deborah Amos reports, the deliveries did not get a warm reception.
This was the furious reaction in Syria's largest camp for the internally displaced near the Turkish border. "We don't need your aid," they shouted, "not from Assad's killers," as the UN trucks rumbled into the camp, along with cars and staff from the Syrian Red Crescent. Atme Camp shelters more than 20,000 in flimsy tents. They live with dire shortages. Atme is a symbol of the desperate plight of millions of Syrians who fled the fighting and have nowhere else to go.
One of the men was crying. One of the men was saying, "What is Bashar doing? He's killing us. He's bombing our houses. And then he sent us tents."
Raga Abdullah was in the camp when the UN trucks arrived. She works for the Maram Foundation, a private charity founded by Syrian activists.
The women stood behind and they were saying that we need these tents, but the men refused to have them.
Do you think this event in Atme was a failure for UN aid delivery?
Unfortunately, yes.
Aid has been politicized in Syria, with documented cases of Red Crescent volunteers arrested and even killed for work in anti-government cities. But top officials are known to be close to the Assad regime. Many activists draw a distinction between the management and Red Crescent volunteers, but in Atme, there was deep suspicion of any government presence. Another aid worker witnessed the rejection of crucial tents and blankets. She only gives her first name, Maysoon, to protect her family.
"People don't trust. And actually, when the texts were coming in, the children were shouting, 'Hey, these are full of explosives,' because they come from the Red Crescent."
These first aid deliveries came after intense negotiations between the Syrian government, the UN, and the Syrian opposition, who say there was an agreement to keep Red Crescent cars out of the camp, but Red Crescent officials insisted on taking part. Negotiations continued last night to salvage the operation, according to an opposition official. All the UN tents and blankets for Atme have been trucked to a warehouse for now. When the Assad government approved UN deliveries to rebel areas, it was considered a breakthrough. But the government also insisted aid must come from Damascus, a journey of hundreds of miles, and through government-approved aid groups, which is causing tensions, says Yatsen Shishekli, who heads the Maram Foundation based in southern Turkey.
"It's already known they're working with the regime, and they're coming under the UN protection, and that's all created a big tension."
Tension is also likely to increase calls for cross-border aid. Atme Camp is directly across the Turkish frontier, less than a five-mile drive. But the UN and other international aid agencies won't cross from Turkey without Syrian government permission. UN officials say it risks other operations inside Syria. For the residents of Atme, shortages will continue as more than 300 Syrian civilians arrive every day. There are not enough tents or blankets for the newcomers. It's a humanitarian catastrophe, says Shishekli, who's seen a steady rise in the number of displaced, far larger than the UN estimates of 3 million.
"It's way bigger than this. You go inside Syria, nobody has a house now, a safe place. Everybody's running. You see people on the street. Inside Damascus, inside Aleppo, every family moved somewhere."
The humanitarian crisis is only growing, he says, and the international response is failing Syria. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Antakya.
Pope Benedict XVI made his first public appearance this morning since announcing his resignation. He was greeted with a standing ovation, told the faithful at the Vatican's main audience hall he's stepping down for the good of the Church. This comes as new details about his health are released. He had heart surgery recently to replace a pacemaker. Still, his resignation remains perplexing because it is extraordinarily rare for a pope to resign. We called Professor Christopher Bolito at Kane University to walk us back. Good morning, Professor Bolito.
Good morning.
Could you tell me who was the first ever pope to resign?
Sure. We think it's a fellow named Pontian in the year 235. Now, you have to remember that we're not entirely sure because those first couple of centuries are pretty murky. Christianity is an illegal religion in the Roman Empire, and so we don't always have all of the sources that we'd like. But we're pretty sure that Pontian was the first one. He was martyred, or in this case, he knew he was going to be martyred because he was going to be deported to a prison on the island of Sardinia, which was known to be so brutal, he was clear that he wasn't going to come back. And he didn't want to have a vacuum of leadership, so he resigned so that a successor could be chosen.
There are also much more sort of evil-sounding stories of cardinals and nobility that the cardinals were working for trying to depose various popes.
Well, sure. There's a really horrible period from about 850 till about 1050. And one of the big papal historians, Eamon Duffy, has calculated that in that period of time, one out of three popes died a violent death.
Wasn't there a resignation of a pope whose name was Celestine V? What happened with him?
Celestine V is a really interesting character because he was a very holy man. And sometimes a very holy man doesn't make a very successful pope in a period of time where the papacy is controlled by political families and rival factions.
What are we talking about? What time are we talking about?
Just at the end of the 13th century, and particularly I'm talking about the year 1294. There hasn't been a pope for a few years. Nobody can decide. It's a deadlock. And so the cardinals decide to go outside the conclave and elect a hermit, totally unsuited for the politics of the papal court. But the notion was, well, if we elected a holy man, then maybe he'll come into Rome, he'll clean up, and we can move forward in a spiritual manner. And he just gets eaten by that court. And within 4 months, he decides to resign.
Now, the most frequent reason, though, for resignation has been an abundance of popes. Isn't that right? I mean, where you have more than one pope and somebody has to go.
That's right. So the worst period in church history is the Great Western Schism from 1378 to 1417, when you have first two and then three popes. I tell my students that this is the here a pope, there a pope, everywhere a pope chapter of church history.
Yes.
And it's in that period of time that we have the most recent resignation, Gregory XII, and he was the Roman pope. And in fact, he probably had the best claim to be the legitimate pope, but he decides to metaphorically fall on his sword.
Obviously, having more than one pope has been a problem for the church, even if it was a mere 600 years ago. But it seems that as though the Vatican is sort of thinking about it now. They're issuing all sorts of press releases to squelch the idea that when Benedict retires, there will once again be two popes.
Well, he has said very clearly, I will renounce the authority. And in that case, de facto, he does not have the authority. He cannot speak with the authority of St. Peter. While we're in unprecedented territory, we're not in uncharted territory. And in fact, Gregory XII, going back to 1415, lived out his life as a cardinal.
Professor Christopher Bolito, he's a historian at Kane University in New Jersey. Professor Bolito, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Morning Edition on KALW San Francisco 91.7 FM. Good morning. I'm Eric Jansen, filling in for Joe Burke today in time for the Daily Almanac for Wednesday, February 13th. The sun rose over San Francisco Bay this morning at 7.01 a.m. and will set this evening at 5.47 p.m., giving us a day of 10 hours and 46 minutes long. The moon rose at 8.39 this morning and will set at 9.50 this evening. On this date in history, in 1542, Catherine Howard, the fifth wife of King Henry VIII, was executed for adultery. Johann Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz was played for the first time in Vienna on this date in 1867. In 1920, the League of Nations recognized the continued neutrality of Switzerland. In 1955, Israel acquired four of the seven Dead Sea Scrolls. In 1960, France detonated its first atomic bomb. In 1971, South Vietnamese troops invaded Laos, backed by U.S. air and artillery support. And in 1972, Led Zeppelin was forced to cancel a concert in Singapore when officials wouldn't let them off the plane because of their long hair. In 2000, on this day, February 13th, Charles M. Schulz's last original Sunday Peanuts comic strip appeared in newspapers. Schulz had died just the day before. If February 13th is your birthday, you share it with 18th century painter Giovanni Piazzetta, Bess Truman, Tennessee Ernie Ford, pilot Chuck Yeager, Dorothy McGuire of the McGuire Sisters, Kim Novak, George Siegel, and these three all on the same date in 1944, Jerry Springer, Stockard Channing, and Peter Tork of the Monkees. You also share this birthday with my mom, who turns 90 today and doing quite well. Happy birthday, Marion. I've always called her by her first name. I did grow up in Berkeley, after all. Fresh Air comes your way at 9 o'clock, about 9 minutes from now, after Cross Currents.
From KALW News in San Francisco, I'm Hanat Baba with the Cross Currents Morning Report. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Outer Mission.
I live in the Nastro.
I live in the Mistro.
La Playa.
I live in the Transmission.
Haight-Ashbury.
I'm in the sunny but filthy Mission.
Formal debate, an ancient Greek tradition, has existed for years as a main staple for political process. Two people get together and duke it out over topics like nationalized healthcare versus private, for example. One side takes pro, the other con. Each speaker then argues his or her case using evidence and citing sources.
Dickinson of Pennsylvania.
One colony cannot be allowed to take its sister colonies headlong into the maelstrom of war.
Well, in case you haven't heard of it, there's a newish style called urban debate. It allows students to use personal experience and new styles.
Why am I to descend to the hard living conditions that'll make the realest killers want to quiver in their boots? Why is racism had to plague my family's roots? Why the owners was eating lobster, we were starving on potato soup and the garbage available. So it's hard to trust anybody after that. They said the racism ain't alive, but we swimming in its aftermath. But textbooks won't tell you that, so I spent the amount like a telepath through my paragraphs.
Reporter Kim Ipp recently attended a tournament, and she brings us this story.
Urban debate has existed since 1985 and has continued to evolve, making it a national phenomenon. It's popular locally, too. Today's tournament is sponsored by the Bay Area Urban Debate League.
Okay, I'm ready.
Flash.
We're on the UC Berkeley campus, and debate rounds are happening simultaneously in many classrooms. Students are typing furiously on laptops and flipping through papers to do any last-minute tweaking on their arguments.
Answer that.
The topic this round is transportation infrastructure. The teams are Skyline High School versus Cal Prep Academy. Debater Leonard Oscar Irving Thomas, otherwise known as Prodigy on the Beat, is a 15-year-old sophomore of Skyline. He lets me tag along on his debate adventure. I'm lucky enough to sit in on a round and catch one example of a developing urban debate style, rap debate, or what Leonard calls being narrativical.
By being narrativical, we are using personal narratives, personal stories to build it. Like, for instance, when I was talking, doing the rap song, lay away, pistol play, everybody on lay away, so I lay awake and wait for the gunshots around my spot to fade away. I was using a personal experience of the fact, yeah, there was shooting at my house last week, the week before that, and the week before that. So I'm bringing it in there to express what the problem is. Instead of using somebody's evidence from some Harvard professor that's never actually been in an urban area, because we are the experts of urban areas because that's where we live.
Unlike traditional debate, which relies strictly on research and hard evidence to win the argument, urban debate allows for personal stories. That appeals to Thomas.
I ended up loving it for the same reason I love rap, because I can express my ideas in a free open world and have people listen, which is something I've been craving for like years now.
Leonard says urban debate offers a forum for students who feel limited by the norms of traditional debate.
I bring my culture in when I do hip-hop. When I rap, I speak the language of the people I see in front of me instead of talking about the norms.
Norms are regularly challenged in urban debate, and Balboa High debater Miranda Pettiford is no stranger to questioning the rigidity of debate structure.
If you want to do more education, then a parliamentary debate style or an open forum would be better than coming in with a policy debate with a plan like this.
Miranda is referring to Leonard's plan to start a movement to liberate the oppressed by educating minorities about the history of racial violence against them. She argues against the debate structure of timed rounds, saying that it doesn't allow for plans such as Leonard's to take flight.
Well, that's just, you know, my opinion, but since everything about here is opinion, it's awesome! Okay.
Time's up! It's Leonard's turn to battle for Skyline.
Politicians keep hollering about problems, but I ain't gonna vote. Keep talking about change, but we floating in the same old boat. Yo, so how am I supposed to feel when the president spoke? When he ain't never had to struggle. He ain't never been broke. He ain't never rolled through the ghetto. He ain't never been close. Trusting the government's like trusting the mother effing devil with notes. So now I'm a rebel with quotes. Lifestyles of the young, black, and reckless. A generation of Negroes strapped up and asking questions like, why I ain't got ish? Instead, I let the liquor fill my toxins, and as I begin to sip, I get up. I would like to...
Urban debate encourages unconventional debate styles like Leonard's, who integrates rap into his arguments. But urban debate also adheres to the structure of traditional debate, where two opposing teams formulate pro and con arguments, and strict time limits are enforced. Despite these formalities, debaters are able to create impassioned arguments that are relevant to the debater and his or her community.
As long as the urban communities remain in this hell, this third world that they are in right now, then we got a problem. And we need to figure out who can solve that because the urban people are the oppressed and they don't do jack diddly squats. Well, we are going directly to the problem. They're using the United States federal government. Well, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. That's going to be the end of my speech.
Two rounds down, one more to go. It's now 1:30, and Leonard and his debate partner are just getting into their third round. Through urban debate, Leonard has found a community to thrive in, personally and politically.
So, simply, we're just trying to bring diversity in debate, and being hip-hop allows culture into it, and us to bring in our circumstance. So, that's what I wanted to bring to debate. I wanted to bring me in. I'm a hip-hop artist. I wanted to bring me into it. And let other people do the same.
Leonard came to urban debate about a year ago. He's been rapping since the third grade. Before getting involved with Skyline Debate Team, he realized his rap was going nowhere because the songs were all about money, cars, and women, just like everybody else's.
Honestly, I didn't even feel like I was doing as good as just another regular rapper and talking all that. But as soon as I stepped into something that I felt beneficial, I felt like meaning, and I really wanted to do that.
Debate gives Leonard a new platform for his rhymes and the opportunity to cultivate a new style.
Debate I use is simply a way to, it's a way of learning how to express yourself. Many people my age don't know about political ideas, but once they step into the debate room, they can learn about not only the United States federal government, the judicial legislatures, and all those particular branches, but they can learn just how decisions are made so they know how to put their own input and make their own change.
The tournament ends with a trophy ceremony.
In second place, from Skyline High, Chris Marquez and Leonard Irving Thomas.
Skyline High School debaters dance for a minute of MC Hammer glory. They have the most debaters at the tournament out of any school. Leonard moves confidently at the front of the crowd, knowing he not only has the title of best varsity speaker, but he's found a community to express himself. For Cross Currents, I'm Kim Ip.
Kim Ip is a student reporter at Mills College in Oakland. You can find links to her story and all of our education reporting at our website. It's klw.org. Click news. For KALW News, I'm Hanat Baba.
You're listening to KALW San Francisco 91.7 FM. If you're on Facebook, becoming a fan or liking KALW is an easy way to spread the word about the programming you value here on local public radio. It's easy. Just click the Facebook link on the front page of our website, kalw.org. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's Fresh Air with the Writer's Almanac from Garrison Keillor from 9:01 to 9:06. Then at 10 o'clock, it's Your Call with your host, Holly Kernan. Stay tuned. KALW 91.7 FM and online at klw.org.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the ancient manuscripts dating back to just before the time of Jesus that were found between 1947 and 1956 in caves by the Dead Sea. Why were they there? Who wrote them? And what have they taught us about Jewish and Christian history? We'll talk with John J. Collins, author of The Dead Sea Scrolls, a biography. He says the scrolls offer insights into what kind of Messiah people then were expecting.
Most people wanted a big, strong warrior who would drive out the Romans, who would smash heads.
Kind of action hero.
And, you know, if you look at this, then, from the viewpoint of the New Testament, the question is, why would anybody have thought that Jesus of Nazareth fit that description?
Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by Indian-American saxophonist Rudresh Mahanthapa. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 13th of February, 2013. It's the birthday of the novelist Georges Simenon, born in Liège, Belgium, 1903, best known for his detective novels featuring Inspector Maigret. He wrote some 400 books, each of which took him on average 8 days to write. This is the week of Valentine's Day. We are here to remind you of that. It is tomorrow. And to put you in mind of love letters, the beauty of them, should you be moved to write one, as Nathaniel Hawthorne did, author of The Scarlet Letter. He wrote love letters to an older woman, Sophia Peabody, whom he married, and on his first wedding anniversary wrote to her, "We were never so happy as now, never such wide capacity for happiness, yet overflowing with all that the day and every moment brings to us. Methinks this birthday of our married life is like a cape, which we have now doubled and find a more infinite ocean of love stretching out before us." And James Joyce, the author of complex fiction containing enigmas and puzzles and wordplay, wrote so simply to his great love, Nora Barnacle. In 1909, he wrote, "You are my only love. You have me completely in your power. I know and feel that if I am to write anything fine or noble, I shall do so only by listening to the doors of your heart. I love you deeply and truly, Nora. There is not a particle of my love that is not yours. If you would only let me, I would speak to you of everything in my mind. But sometimes I fancy from your look that you would only be bored by me. Anyhow, Nora, I love you. I cannot live without you. I would like to give you everything that is mine, any knowledge I have, any emotions I myself feel or have felt, any likes or dislikes I have, any hopes I have or remorse. I would like to go through life side by side with you, telling you more and more until we grew to be one being together, until the hour should come for us to die. Even now the tears rush to my eyes and sobs choke my throat as I write this. Nora, we have only one short life in which to love. Oh, my darling, be only a little kinder to me. Bear with me a little, even if I am inconsiderate and unmanageable, and believe me, we will be happy together. Let me love you in my own way. Let me have your heart always close to mine, to hear every throb of my life, every sorrow, every joy." Here's a poem for today by Hal Sirovitz, entitled Undecided.
Your mother and I didn't know what to get you for a present, Father said. We kept asking you, but you wouldn't tell us. So we got what's good for all occasions, a shirt. But since we've given you that for your last three birthdays, we were hoping to give you something different. We were thinking of just giving you cash, but that'd have been too impersonal. Plus, you might have saved it and not spent it. This way, even if you don't wear them, we might still get some use out of them. If you suddenly started accusing us of never getting you anything, we could open your drawer and show you the shirts. Just because you don't wear them doesn't negate our intent. Undecided by Hal Surovitz from his collection Father Said, published by Soft Skull Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by the National Geographic Channel, presenting Killing Lincoln, based on the novel by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Killing Lincoln premieres this Sunday at 8 p.m. Engineered by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
One way you can keep in touch with us here at KLW is to sign up for our email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the front page of klw.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered after World War II, they became a treasure for scholars studying the era just before, during, and after the life of Jesus, and the subject of acrimonious debate. There's still a lot we don't know about who wrote them and why they were hidden in caves near the Red Sea. My guest, John J. Collins, is the author of the new book, The Dead Sea Scrolls, a biography. That's part of a Princeton University Press series called Lives of Great Religious Books. Collins is a professor of Old Testament criticism and interpretation at Yale. The scrolls are believed to have been written by the Jewish sect, the Essenes. They separated themselves from the world and largely practiced celibacy, leading some scholars to see them as a group foreshadowing Christian monasteries. They wrote of a teacher who has some similarities to Christ. The scrolls also contain apocalyptic writing and offer insights into what this community was expecting.